So welcome everyone. Before we return to Master Shuyun's discourses on Zen, any burning questions? So just for a quick reminder, Master Shuyun, H-S-U-Y-U-N, was really the 20th century, 19th and 20th century Chan slash Zen, a master of China, renowned. He actually lived, as I said, I think last time we talked, he actually lived into the 60s and experienced the Red Guards, you know, and that whole fanatical movement in the 60s, but living 120 years, he began in the 1840s. So it was quite a life. And his autobiography and information about him can be found online. Quite an extraordinary master in many ways. So this is a discourse he gave it says, a discourse that he intended for his senior monks. And I'll just read what we read last time, but I won't comment on it. We'll get right into the second part. He says, many people come to ask me for guidance. This makes me feel ashamed. Everyone works so hard, splitting firewood, hoeing the fields, carrying soil, moving bricks, and yet from morning to night, not putting down the thought of practicing the way. Such determination for the path of awakening is touching. I, Shuyun means, usually translates empty cloud. That was his name, empty cloud. A beautiful Zen name. I, empty cloud, repent my inadequacy on the path and my lack of virtue. I am unable to instruct you and can use only a few sayings from the ancients in response to your questions. And then he goes on to say, there are four prerequisites concerning methods of practice. And the last time we talked about the first one, which was deep faith in the law of cause and effect, which has already been recorded and at some point will appear on the website. Again, I think this is very important because Zen has a funny kind of misreputation. Because what is mostly known about Zen are its koans and all the kind of wondrous but highly paradoxical interchanges, the anecdotes between masters and students, we think that's kind of like that's Zen. But the truth is that if you read the lives of the Zen masters, and if you read the lives of the Zen students, you saw that they were engaging in lots of traditional types of training prior to their more imaginative and we could say deeper, more focused meditative practice, which led to their awakening, where they really had the capacity to not just intellectually, but directly and intuitively understand the nature of mind and nature of their own reality. So Shuyun, before he talks more deeply about Zen practice to his monks, he says there are four prerequisites. Prerequisites means what? You know, what you have to do first. And last time we talked about deep faith and the law of cause and effect. Faith is a translation, probably confidence or trust is probably closer to what the actual Chinese means. So again, just in summary, the first thing, and we could say not a prerequisite just for Zen practice, but the prerequisite for any type of spiritual practice, we have to understand how things unfold according to causes and condition. That this is not a random universe, nor is it a fated universe. We are not the playthings of the gods. We are not the playthings of something called fate. nor is this just a totally randomized universe where anything can happen and nothing has any meaning. Things unfold because of causes and conditions. Everything that exists, whether it exists in the world of form, whether it exists in the world of thought, whether it exists in the world of relationship and interaction, there is always an antecedent. And obviously not just one antecedent. Many times there are many, many, many antecedents and variables that all come together to produce an effect. And that effect, when it happens, immediately becomes what? A new cause. So it's an endless movement of cause and effect. Understanding that allows us to bring understanding and compassion to the way things are arising right now. Right? Because we understand clearly that there are causes and conditions. Anything that's arising or happening right now, whether inside me, to me, with me, to the world, it is because of past causes and conditions. Right? Okay. Now, that frees us from all that obsession and that blame and that guilt and that overanalyzing, et cetera, that we tend to get into, right? In terms of how did I get here, or how did the world get here, or why is this happening, right? But it also from the practice point of view, which means the healing transformation point of view, it also means that that the way I am intervening, the way I am acting, the way I am responding to causes and conditions in the present has everything to do with how my future also will unfold. And whether that's my personal future, our future, or the world's future collectively. Right? We all hold that responsibility. And understanding that the actions of our body, speech, and mind are creating effects that will ripple out makes us much more conscious and aware and careful and considerate about the way we act today. Many of us come here meaning not just this physical place or this meditation group, but come here to meditate over spiritual practice. Why? Because we want some sort of shift to occur in our life. We want something to be transformed. We want something to change. We want something to be different, right? And what we often come with an expectation of instantaneous transformation, right? That is hoped for, isn't it? But if one is serious and stays around long enough, one understands what? It doesn't, unfortunately, work that way. Right? Why? Because each of us is the heir, is the inheritor of all the causes and effects which are ripening from our past, which not only includes us as individuals, but family, parents, societal, it's all kind of ripening right now, right? And that karmic energy that is coming from the past, for most of us, especially for the stronger stuff, right? We are not a kayak, let's say. Kayak is very sensitive and can very easily be turned. Most of us our karmic load is more like a cruise boat or something. It's large, and even though we may be turning the wheel, the boat will not just turn on a dime, let's say, right? So we can be turning the wheel, right? The wheel of our karma, the wheel of our life, the wheel of the way we are acting, thinking, behaving, etc. But yet, the transformation, the shift that we are seeking is going to happen over time. Right? And that's just the way it is. Of course, what that means is if we don't turn the wheel, the shift is not going to happen, right? And on the other hand, if we turn the wheel quickly, look around, see the boat hasn't turned the way we want immediately, and get discouraged and let the wheel go, the transformation will not come about either, will it? So understanding the law of cause and effect is understanding the nature of this turning. Understanding it deeply and having faith in it and trust in it is understanding that because everything comes about because of causes and conditions, if I am very conscious in the transformation of the causes and conditions that I'm creating in my life, which means the way I think, the way I act, the way I speak, the way I relate, right? In body, speech, and mind, the more that I bring those actions of body, speech, and mind into harmony, we could say, with an altruistic vision of what it means to be a human being. Or we could say, the more that I bring the actions of my body, speech, and mind into harmony with my own true nature, a nature that is uncontaminated by self-centeredness and self-cherishing, right? The more I do that, the more naturally the healing and transformation that I seek in my life and in my relations from others will definitely occur. You could say, well, that's a pretty strong word, right? Definitely occur. But I can say that, as all the teachers have said it, because we understand that, again, one, this is not a totally random universe, and two, this is not a universe controlled by forces totally outside ourselves. Right? Each of us, to one degree or another, has the capacity for transformation. How total that transformation is depends on two things. Well, at least two things. That's on many things. But one thing is the energy of our aspiration for transformation and the energy that we put into that on a consistent basis, moment to moment, hour to hour, day to day, right? Combined with what? Sort of the heaviness of our load. And that's a, you know, that's a very interesting kind of variable. That's what we work with, right? We work with what? We work with ourselves. Each of us are working with ourselves. And what that means, only each of us know, right? But meeting that is, again, the level of aspiration, the level of energy, the level of commitment that we are putting into our desire to lead a better life, to lead an awakened life, to become a Buddha, you know, whatever your level of aspiration is, to be live more in the present moment, to be happier, right? You know what I'm saying? There's all different ways we, each of us, may personalize or conceptualize what this path is about for us. But whatever it is in our hands. And the one thing that the Buddhist path offers and all the teachers say is we do have that capacity for happiness and freedom. We are all heir, that's H-E-I-R, to that inheritance. That is our inheritance as human beings. And our capacity to live that is based on our own, again, our own energetic application of the path. So that's number one. Number two, he says, is strict observance of the precepts. And again, people who are, you know, are familiar with Zen masters and teachers shouting at each other and banging around each other and throwing enigmatic phrases at each other may be surprised that strict observance of precepts is a prerequisite. Now, what's called the precepts here in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition is now called mindfulness trainings for various reasons. But what we're talking about is what we might call moral conduct. Right? But really what it means is if number one is about cause and effect, right? And if I know that my actions of my body and the actions of my speech and my actions of my mind are creating effects positive and negatively, right? How do I kind of very quickly minimize the suffering that the actions of my body, speech, and mind are causing myself and others, right? That's what the precepts are about. They are guidelines. They go back in Buddhism, they go back to the Buddha himself, where he elucidated 5 and 10 various kinds of precepts, trainings for his lay community, and hundreds of ones for his monastic community. And if we follow them, and the more we follow them impeccably, the more we just are removing very easily realms of conflict and suffering that we impose on ourselves and others. And just very quickly, we won't go into it. I know that there is ongoing discussion here of the trainings, but this has to do with things such as not killing, which actually means more like not doing harm, not harming ourselves, not harming our body, not harming others, and it means conversely a willingness to be protective, to offer protection to life. Quite simply, again, to make a commitment to do the least harm to myself and others in this life, and to make that very conscious, right? I was talking to somebody yesterday, and they said they've kind of reduced their daily practice to today can I at a minimum do no harm to anyone, and at a maximum can I do good for people as I go through this day. The second one has to do traditionally with not taking what is not given, often brought down to not stealing. But it really is bigger than that. It's often said as, you know, I will respect the things of others. Right? I will not take what is not given. Now, obviously, to take a property, right, that belongs to somebody else, you know, robbery or stealing, is an obvious one. But I think it goes deeper than that. You know, we're in a very difficult situation in our planet, in our ecology, right? Because as a human race, we are taking more than we are giving back, aren't we? We're taking from animal life, we're taking from plant life, we're taking from the air, from the earth, from the waters. We're taking things out of the earth that are really aren't rightfully ours to take. And in doing that, we are, as you know, we are destroying a lot of the balance of nature. We are taking that which we shouldn't be taking. Often we take from other people. We exploit other people for our own benefit. We take what is not freely given. We manipulate. We control. We exploit. So again, you know, lots of different meanings. The third has to do with sexuality. In the Buddha's time, issues of sexuality were more about kind of relationship things. In other words, it was like a list of, you know, fathers don't have sex with their daughters, mothers don't have sex with their sons, sisters and brothers don't have sex with each other. You don't have sex with a, it was again obviously skewed toward men, you wouldn't have, it was considered, you don't have sex with a young woman who's still under the care of her family, things like that. But again, I think it's the whole issue of sexuality in terms of the precepts is how do we not use other people simply for our own pleasure. How do we not use other people just to meet our own needs? How do I not do harm? And how do I use the capacity for sexual enjoyment as to create meaning and connection in lives? The fourth one has to deal with speech. And here we're talking about the obvious, that speech, again, speech is the primary way we relate to one another. We've all noticed that, right? I mean, we talk to one another. Have you noticed that, human beings? We talk a lot together. And that is the probably the biggest way we create relationship. And so there's a deep understanding there that our words can create suffering. Our words can create conflict. Our words can create division. Our words can hurt. In other words, our words have the capacity of creating suffering all over the place for ourselves and others. At the same time, our words have the capacity to bring understanding, to calm, right? To express love, empathy. Our words can bring together. Our words can be constructive, be positive. So it's very, the fourth precept really enjoins us to be very aware of the effects of our words. And I'd also add, there's another kind of language dialogue that goes on, which is often not talked about in the traditional Buddhist interpretation of the fourth, which is each of us have an internal dialogue with ourself. And so, to me, the practice also means, is my dialogue with myself loving, compassionate, supportive, constructive, helpful, right? Or is my dialogue with myself toxic, negative, sabotaging, destructive, right? So it's not just the words we speak out loud, but it's the words we think. I think of all have to do with right speech. And the fifth training traditionally has to do with intoxicants. And it really has to do with the awareness that having a clear mind is essential to the practice. It's essential to following through on the other four that we've already mentioned, right? As well, it's essential to have a clear mind if one wants to practice meditation, mindfulness, etc., etc. And it is a well-known reality. Perhaps many of us here have experienced it in the past or continue to experience that the use and abuse of intoxicants, legal and illegal, can be highly problematic. Obviously, in the realm of addiction, we know it is a very painful experience for individuals, families, and society. But we also just know that so many of the difficulties that people have in relationships, bad scenes, angers, violence, aggression, battering, abuse, you know, a lot of the things that occur in our society, intoxicants are overwhelmingly present in these experiences, right? We know if we look at so many of our brothers and sisters who are in jail, in prison, we know intoxicants are very much part of the pathology that has brought them to that place. So both from a societal level and a personal level, looking at the use of intoxicants and what that does to the mind is very important. If you bring these five together, you can see what? One has now the capacity, if one is really observing these five trainings or precepts very consciously and carefully, that one really has eliminated from one's life, right? Just by that, has eliminated from their life so much negativity, so many problems, so much of the stuff that causes us emotional pain, suffering, relationship pain and suffering, and brings so much pain and suffering to our families and friends and our society, right? This is, you know, this is even before we cross our legs, right? This is even before we practice mindfulness and living in the present moment and insight, right? So that's why the Master Xu Yin said this is a prerequisite, right? It means that when you come to your meditation, your mind is not disturbed by anger and fears and worries and regret, right? Because you've developed the capacity within your life. It's interesting. Thich Nhat Hanh wrote a book just on the five precepts, mindfulness trainings, and I think he called it For a Future to be Possible. He really addressed it to the world. He basically said, if the whole world, forget about whatever religion or non-religion, this path that people are following, if everyone in the world just followed these five precepts, right? So many of the social evils and difficulties would be immediately eliminated. Right? So please, it's important that we do not see ourselves as somebody above or beyond the need to follow basic precepts of conduct in the use of our body, conduct in the words we speak, and conduct of the thoughts of our mind. Now the third prerequisite is translated as immovable faith. Now, traditionally Zen Buddhism is not considered a faith-based religion. So you may wonder, what is he, what's being talked about here? And again, I think usually what that character that's often translated as faith, it's a mistranslation. It's usually really more means in the Chinese trust in, confidence in, which has a very different connotation. So when he says immovable confidence, immovable trust, as one of the main prerequisites to spiritual transformation and awakening, he's talking about, from a Zen perspective, two major things. The first, and I've said it before and I'll say it again and again, because it is really the basis of the Buddha's awakening, and it definitely is the basis of the Zen, Chan, Dzogchen, the meditative traditions within Buddhism. It is that each of us have our Buddhas, intrinsically Buddhas. And whether we call that our Buddha nature, our pure mind, our God nature, our whatever, those are just words. But they all point that each of us have this immaculate nature. The very nature of our experience, the very nature of our mind, the very nature of our consciousness and awareness, which is pure, undefiled, and is the repository of all goodness. This is something we have to have confidence in, trust in. Now, why do we have to have confidence or trust or faith? Right? Why does he say that? Because for most of us, this is not our current experience, right? Most of us, our current experiences, our minds are just a mess, neurotic, all over the place, labile, untrustworthy, fickle, right? So when we go, You know, this is not my experience, right? So, in a certain sense, in terms of this tradition, that's something we have to have a trust in, right? Because it's not, for most of us, our current immediate experience. So we have to be willing to take on faith that it is true. Now, what can we base our faith on? Well, we can base our faith on, going back to the Buddha, this was his direct experience. And then we can base the faith on, for 2,500 years, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, or tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people have practiced this way and report the same thing. They have awakened to their true nature and report their capacity to experience the pure, immaculate, uncontaminated nature of their own mind, their Buddha mind. Because of this, we can say it is true, and I believe that it is my inheritance as a human being. I don't have to manufacture it. I don't have to buy it. Right? It is here. I just have to uncover it. So that's one piece of the immovable faith, is that that we have this true Buddha nature, and we all have this capacity within us. The second thing I think that we have to have a movable faith, or confidence, trust, better word, is that each of us has the capacity to realize it. Right? My own experience for many people is many people do not, they doubt their capacity. Right? So somebody might say, yes, yeah, I believe the Buddha. I believe the masters. I believe the teachers. Yes, we do have this true nature that has been undefiled by all the nonsense I've been through in this life and all the things I've done and the things I've thought and blah, 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 blah. I believe that this nature has continued to remain uncontaminated and pure. But I'm just too screwed up. Right? I'm too neurotic. I'm too weak. I'm too fragile. Right? I don't believe I really have the capacity to heal and transform myself. Right? That is only for the spiritual elite. Right? This is only for the Olympianods. Is that a word? Olympianods? I don't know. Olympians? Thank you. Those people of special capacity. But I am just an ordinary human being, and I can only be satisfied with, reading about it. And if I just get a little peace in my mind, or I become a little kinder in this life, do a little less harm than I used to do, that's probably all I'm capable of. Maybe next lifetime. So, to doubt one's capacity to awaken, right, is to ensure that one will not awake. Right? One has to trust that when the teachers tell us not only that we have this innate nature that we can awaken to, but that each of us have the capacity to do it. It is not that difficult. It is not that hard. Right? It's actually fairly simple. Well, Jacqueline's going, it's fairly simple. We just got to follow, it's like following the recipe. There are many people here, I am sure, who they open the book, they get the recipe, but then they don't follow the recipe. Right, yeah, they're kind of like, maybe I'll cut this out, or this is a shortcut, or I'll substitute this for that. We get very creative in our, and then we wonder why it kind of doesn't turn out the way it the picture looked, or the description. The path, and again, I'm just talking about the Buddhist path. There are other paths too. very clear, very delineated path. Right? Very simple. Do this, don't do that. Right? That's all. But there's something about us. Now we just... How would you put it, David? What is it we do? What?
I like to be trailblazers.
You mean off the path?
Yeah.
Right. Here's the path, going straight to where we want to go, but we go, you know, something over here, right? Or I'm going to do it my way, or right? I want to investigate this. And I mean, that's fine, right? But then... Don't be frustrated that you're not getting where you want to get to. Don't blame it on the path. Right? The path is clear. We need to ask ourselves, am I really walking it the way the teachers have told us to walk it? Right? So this is, and again, you know, I mean, I'm just sharing Master Xu Yun's prerequisites. Again, they sound simple, right? But you know, the Buddha said, listen to my teachings and then reflect on them. Right? Right? Which, and we reflect on them, he meant, you know, chew on them. You know, chew on them. Contemplate them. Think about them. Do they make sense to me? Do I understand them? Do I really want to bring them into my life? Am I serious about it? So, traditionally, what Xu Yun is doing here is saying that process are usually prerequisite before we jump into it. Right? But many of us kind of jump into it without going through the prerequisite, without asking the right questions, without really reflecting on, you know, why am I really here? Why am I meditating? Why am I practicing mindfulness? What really is my aspiration, personally, in terms of my own transformation and healing? You know? Right? Do I really believe that I have a true nature, that I have a Buddha mind, that I have within me all the capacity for happiness and well-being and serenity that I could ever need? I don't need to go looking for it. It's right here. Right? Do I really believe that? Right? And if I do, do I really trust my own capacity and believe in my own capacity to do it? Now again, you know, there's lots of other things that can help us stay on the path. But these are something that we should reflect on. So again, trust, confidence in my own true nature, and my own capacity to be awake, to be fully alive. And to really be a compassionate, selfless human being who can live their life with joy and equanimity. Right? So these are things to... And then the last one, maybe we'll save this for next time, since it's almost time. Which is choosing a Dharmadhora method of practice. This is an important one. We'll talk about this next time. Dharmadhoras. Anybody know how many Dharmadhoras there are? What? 94? 84,000? 108,000? Limitless. Limitless. Yeah. But oftentimes they're gone 84,000, 108,000. Limitless. Yeah. Dharmadhoras. All different ways to enter this world of truth.
I'm a long time ago, Fred. I just
Mm-hmm. Like, what does that mean?
Well, it means that if you're in a situation and you're wanting to rationalize that you've got causes and conditions, they're beyond your control, they're out of your control, you really are powerless to do anything. But then you have this other issue of your karma, which is, okay, so what my actions?
No, but karma is the law of cause and effect. Karma means cause and effect.
Then maybe I should refer to it as personal karma. People talk about their personal karma.
Right, but it's nothing. Again, so you know, let's take the oil spill, right? So we say, oh, you know, there's oil flowing into the Gulf, right? Why? Because causes and conditions, and we can, you know, you read the paper. There's lots of causes and conditions of all types that created to that explosion, and whether it was malfeasance or just the way it happened, or, you know, the policy of Washington, or, you know, who knows, right? Lots of causes and conditions have contributed to the fact what? That there's oil flowing uncontrollably into the Gulf, right? Caused by causes and conditions. Now, how we deal with it, what we do now in relationship to these causes and conditions, is also creating an effect. So that's, you know, the freedom or the will, the free will, which is was somewhat what we're talking about here, is in, yes, I understand, you know, there is nothing I can do now to change the fact that the oil is flowing the way it is, right? That's a given, that's a fact. But from this moment on, right, the new types of actions I'm taking now are creating the cause and conditions for whether these kinds of things will happen in the future. Right? So there's the freedom. In the same way, as an individual, you may have a violent temper, right? And you may understand and aggressive impulses that arise from that violent temper, and you may understand all the causes and conditions in your own life that have caused that to arise right now. Okay? In the past, that arousal of that anger and that tendency to aggress will just continue. You get angry, you aggress back, and it just gets reinforced and it gets strengthened continually. But now you're practicing Dharma, right? You're following the mindfulness trainings. You're practicing mindfulness. It doesn't mean, just because you're doing all those things, that the anger and the aggressive impulse is not arising in you because of causes and conditions from the past. But it means when it's arising now, as opposed to kind of letting somebody have it, right? You put your hands in your pocket and you don't take them out, for starters, right? Even though you have a vicious mouth, right, that in the past would just cut people up, right, when you're angry at them, because you understand the law of karma and you want to change, you may not be able to say a nice word, right? But you can at least cover your mouth or walk away. Now, I mean, those are just very simple examples, right? That the karma of causing good things in the past can still be coming through you. Right? And I'm picking very strong examples. But you have, as you become conscious, the power to begin to make the shift. That's your freedom. Right. You know, in Buddhism we say, practice begins with the second thought. I don't know if you ever heard that term. Practice begins with the second thought. The first thought, like the first impulse, arises because of causes and conditions from your past, right? It's there before you even know it, right? First thought. I'm talking about now in these negative kind of stuff. Your practice begins at the second thought, right? Do I chain something to that first thought, or do I cut that chain so it doesn't manifest the way it did in the past? That's where your freedom is. Not from not having the first thought, but from the first thought doesn't have to lead to the traditional second thought. The anger doesn't have to lead to the aggression. The anger doesn't have to lead to the vicious words. I can cut it. And over time, you can cut it deeper and deeper and deeper. So let us... We will continue. Thank you.